And now, on the African American Athlete Sports Network, it's Express Yourself with host T. Ramon and Sko.
Express Yourself!
It's an hour packed with guests, opinions, sports news of the day, and off-the-field issues that impact play on it. And you, the listeners, will have an opportunity to express yourself on our call-in line as well. Now here's our Express Yourself hosts, veteran sports journalists Tim Turner and Roscoe Nance.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Express Yourself with T. Ramon and Sko. I'm Tim Turner, along with co-host Roscoe Nance. We'll be here for an hour-long program this week just to chop it up on a number of subjects that are going on in the sports world. This is supposed to be like the lull period between the end of the professional football season. You got college basketball wrapping up, and then spring training is going on. But also in the midst of this, there has been football of the recruiting nature. Well, we have with our guest tonight is going to be Donald Ware, who's going to give us the lowdown on recruiting for the FCS HBCUs and where he thinks the top 10 recruiting classes are and who finished out on top. But also this past weekend, although there was a lull, there was some activity in Atlanta here at the Black College Football Hall of Fame where they inducted their latest class. It was a weekend of festivities that were involved around it. And I know, Roscoe, you took part in it. And hello, number one. And just talk about this, what happened this past weekend in Atlanta.
Yeah, the Black College Football Hall of Fame induction ceremony, I mean, it's just a great, great event. You know, it's just like a who's who of, you know, Black college football, you know, with the inductees and the members of the hall who come back. I think it was like 27 of the 54 living inductees were there. And, you know, it was just a great weekend, you know, to be in the room with so much history, you know, just, you know, it gives you chills. And, you know, and this year, you know, you brought in John Taylor and Rich Tombstone Jackson and Timmy Newsom and Coach Ace Mumford and Hugh Douglas. It was just a great weekend. You know, I look forward to it, you know, every year. And I think I just can't, you know, say enough about Doug Williams and Shaq Harris, whose idea this thing was, and who, you know, got it up and running, and just keeps getting bigger and bigger every year.
Well, that's awesome. That's awesome. But and it's outstanding as all those guys were that you mentioned in terms of their HBCU careers. Before they get to HBCUs, they were, I would venture to say, all of them were standouts in the high school level. And, you know, just to help us break it down, it's the guys who are going to be the next stars on the collegiate level. On the line right now is Donald Ware. Donald, how are you doing this evening, sir?
Great. Glad to be on with you guys. You guys doing okay?
Yes, sir.
Doing great, young blood. Doing great. And, you know, I just want to congratulate you on the stellar job that you do, you know, tracking the HBCU recruiting, because I don't think anybody else does that. And for years, you know, that was a void. And it was hard to know who had signed who. Then you come along, and this is 13 years now, and I remember when you first started out doing it. And, you know, you've done a solid job. Now, I don't know how you're able to do it, because it's a lot. It's a lot
yeah,
there.
I, Yeah, I appreciate it. It is a great undertaking. I mean, when we first started, it was 2006, and actually what we used to do is we used to go through what was called the Sports Network when they had the FCS coverage. So I can't remember who the executive director was at the time, but we would just bring him on and, you know, sort of get his thoughts, and we did that for a couple of years and then just branched out to doing it ourselves. And really, we used to get more into it, rank the schools, and then get with the coaches and talk with them and interview them and all that about the classes. So I appreciate you saying that, Roscoe. It has been a huge undertaking. It is definitely a lot of work.
Well, let me ask you this. Since you started this, how has recruiting improved among the HBCUs at the Division I level? Are they getting, you know, better athletes, or about the same? Has it remained about the same, or just what?
Yeah, I think overall you're seeing that it's better than when we started in 06, but it's hit and miss sometime. Like, this year was probably the best year. Like, typically, you know, when we've done this, it's been a, you know, maybe even last year, the year before, it was like, okay, we got five schools. Now we need to find five more. This year, it was schools were left out, you know, so it was one of those deals where I think this year was extraordinary. I think overall, since 2006, recruiting has gotten better. But sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's sort of an up and down deal.
Well, let's get into it and talk about who did what in terms of those schools and who they recruited and how they fared.
Well, I know just for a hot second there, I wanted to look at. I saw the who number 10 was tied at number 10, and I was really surprised to see that you had Jackson State up there, given that what they've been going through the past couple of years.
Yeah, I know it's fair because, you know, and I've said this on my show that, you know, I mean, you go through all of these coaching changes, and, you know, when they had Rick Comegy there, you know, they had the APR problems, and they got that under control. He was running a good program, but anyway, I mean, you're sort of right about that in terms of a lot of what they've been going through. But I thought that they did a pretty solid job. All things considered, they had 26 signees, which is a lot of signees. The max you can sign is 30. They had 26, so it's a pretty big class. You know, the way we do it, so I know a lot of people will say, well, you know, you look at some of the FBS transfers, which they were able to get a couple of those, including Didi Bowie, who was a former four-star kid in high school, but, you know, is transferring from Ole Miss. But once you've played college football, the stars become a little bit less from what you did in high school. So that's just sort of the way that we do it. But I thought that they were able to sign a quarterback, even though he hadn't played in a while, and Matt Little out of Western Michigan. They were able to sign, you know, a three-star kid, which was a big deal this year because we saw more three-star players sign than I can remember we ever have seen sign, certainly since I've been doing this. So I thought, you know, I thought Jackson State did a solid job.
That's awesome. And you were just running down for us on the why you picked the schools and why and the rationale behind it, because they were tied at 10 with Alabama A&M.
Yeah. So, and we can do it, you know, sort of going backwards. So, you know, I thought, like you said, with Alabama A&M. So, again, they had a big-time three-star signing in Davion Wheeler from out of Dallas. He played at South Oak Cliff. And this is a kid that could probably come in and sort of have an immediate impact. He had 21 sacks on last year, added another wide receiver, and also to go along with Akil Glass, the quarterback who really was in the running for you know, SWAC Offensive Player of the Year. So I thought they really did a good job overall. At number 9 had Prairie View A&M. You know, Eric Dooley in really his first full class, if you really look at it. You know, they were able to get a couple of transfers in there. A kid like a Jared Scott's a 6'6 wide receiver, 220 pounds, played at Wyoming. I mean, I think he's going to come in is sort of have an immediate impact. A couple of two-star kids that they were able to get as well. You know, a quarterback. Anytime you can get a two- or three-star quarterback, I mean, you know, that definitely bodes well because a lot of the other schools are going to be able to are looking for that kind of guy too. And the thing about it, what was interesting about this class more so this year than any other years is the not only the number of three-star kids that were signed, but the number of ones that had offers to not just FBS programs. Like, you know, you can look at some of these FBS programs, they're lower-tier FBS programs. They're, you know, a lot of times we can win those recruiting battles, but they're, you know, a lot of our schools are recruiting against some of the bigger tier FBS programs, and we'll talk more about some of that player, some of those players, a little bit later on. You know, Grambling at number nine probably, honestly, was now that I look back at it, was low. They had a couple of three-star kids, and then they also, which I thought was really big time for them, they were able to get the Louisiana's all-time, or he was sixth all-time leading rusher in C.J. Russell. So I thought that was a pretty big deal. And, you know, remember, I mean, when you look at sort of Grambling and their running back situation, maybe not last year per se, but in years past, I mean, they've been able to find sort of these diamonds in the rough a little bit. So I thought that they did a pretty good job. We also had in there Prairie View A&M, and we didn't have them tied at nine. I think what happened, just so people get a little bit of background, you know, one of the things we ask is to get all of the information from the various schools, all of the bios, all of whether these guys were three-star, all of that. And so, unfortunately, we didn't have the information that we needed at the time when the rankings initially came out. And so they were omitted initially. But I thought Prairie View A&M, I mean, when you looked at them, they did a really good job. I think where they excelled more so, and if you look at the early signing period, all of their players, I think they signed eight players, all eight of their players were all FBS kids. But they were able to come back in the latter signing period, that first Wednesday in February, and signed a bunch of high school kids that are definitely going to help them, I think, right away. At number eight, we had Howard. Ron Prince, the new coach, signed 20 players. And for them to be able to keep those players with the transition in coaching, I thought they did a really, really good job there. They're already set at quarterback, obviously, with Kalen Newton. And by the way, Howard had, you know, three or four three-star kids that came in, a couple of guys in the secondary that I think are really going to do well for them. But they also had a quarterback, Quentin Williams, who's out of PG, of Prince George's County in Maryland, who originally signed with Morgan State. He was a three-star kid. So that was sort of a coup for Howard to be able to get that kid as opposed to Morgan. And, of course, both of those schools are in the DMV, Howard in D.C., Morgan in Baltimore. Tennessee State at number seven, I mean, they always do a good job each and every year. Again, I think what Rod Reed and his staff prides themselves on is signing offensive linemen. You know, I talked a little bit earlier about the three-star kids. Well, we're seeing this year we saw more schools sign three-star kids. We saw Southern sign seven. We saw A&T sign a bunch. But Tennessee State, year in and year out, signs three-star kids. So it wasn't anything new or special to them per se. They always do a good job of filling in some of the needs that they have on the FBS level. I'll tell you this, one of the things I'm looking to, though, this year as we rank these classes, Tennessee State it sort of underachieved, if you want to be honest about it, these last couple of years. So I think hopefully that some of these guys are definitely going to be able to pan out. A lot of times when you see the two-star and three-star kids, coaches and programs typically are going to redshirt a lot of their freshmen. A lot of these guys that we're talking about that are freshmen aren't going to play right away, but we'll see what happens there with Tennessee State. North Carolina Central,
see,
number
Tennessee
six.
State, I was looking at them this past
year. Yeah, go ahead,
year.
I'm sorry.
One game that sticks in my craw with Tennessee State is they really had a legitimate shot to beat Vanderbilt. And
yeah.
And I was hoping, you know, that this O-line would be helpful because they had some shots near the goal line where they couldn't get the ball in. So when you mentioned them recruiting heavily on the O-line, I'm quite sure some of the alumni have to smile about that.
Yeah, and the thing about it, and I know we're talking about the recruiting deal, but, you know, with, mm-hmm. with like You're right. So they were close to beating a Vanderbilt out of the – I mean, now I get it. Vanderbilt may not be the cream of the crop in the SEC, but at the end of the day, they got more scholarships, and it's an SEC school. But then your record doesn't reflect that. And the same thing last year. You know, they start out the season beating Georgia State. I realize it may be a lower tier FBS, but ultimately at the end of the season, the record did not reflect that. So hopefully, again, some of these guys that they're signing are going to be able to come in and help them right away.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but you're right. Offensive line, I mean, they always do a good job with that, no question about it. And the other thing that Tennessee State always does well is they recruit locally. They had like four or five kids right out of Nashville. And in total of their class, which I believe was 18 kids, like 11 of them were from the state of Tennessee. So they typically always do a really good job of recruiting locally and in the state. At number six had North Carolina Central. Trey Oliver comes, you know, back to Central, and I thought did a really good job. I think the jewel of his class was an offensive lineman. And by the way, Roscoe, that information you sent me was really good. This Michael Cartwright kid that you sent me earlier on. I mean, I talked a little bit about it earlier on. You had guys that were three-star kids that were turning down big-time schools. This kid turned down Nebraska, Pitt, Temple, Pittsburgh, UCF, and a lot of other schools to play at North Carolina Central. So I thought that was a pretty big deal. Plus, they signed two other three-star kids as well. So I thought Central did a good job. And by the way, one of the kids that Central signed was a kid, last name Witherspoon. He's out of Greensboro's Ben L. Smith. And he had 21 sacks last year, right? Daryl Johnson, who was the defensive player of the year and all of that, left early out of A&T to go to to declare herself eligible for the National Football League. So, you know, A&T not able to sign a local kid who may have been able to come in and, you know, sort of either help them right away or been part of that process that A&T likes to do, which is redshirt kids. And that's why A&T has been so successful. If you look at A&T's roster and you look by their name, the classification of most of their kids, 80% of those kids are going to have a redshirt by their name, and that's why I think they've been successful and had the success that they've been able to have at A&T. At number five, Florida A&M. Boy, I tell you, Willie Simmons, man, he does a really good job. I mean, if you look at what he was able to do last year, he essentially last year recruited two schools. He recruited, obviously, when he was at Prairie View A&M. They were a top 10 class last year. He also recruited a little bit of time he had at Florida A&M before the recruiting process started when he got the job last year. And Florida A&M was in our top 10 last year. This year at number five, you know, and Florida A&M is another one that does a really good job. 19 players, 16 of those players from the state of Florida. Four of those kids were local kids right out of Tallahassee that has, you know, some really good football. At number four, Bethune-Cookman. And they're in this class. Terry Sims and his staff do a good job each and every year, year in and year out. They're right there in the top five. They had a couple of three-star kids that they were able to sign. A couple of offensive linemen, as a matter of fact. I can't remember the kid's name, but he had offers from Florida, Louisville, and UCF, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, they were able to sign, you know, some guys, and I think some defensive guys. They had a kid on there that had like 21 and a half sacks, something like that, that's going to be able to help them right away on next year. At number three was Alcorn. So, man, when I initially looked at Alcorn's class, I'm like, man, I thought they were, and I had already looked at Southern's class, and I had already looked at North Carolina A&T's class. When I looked at North Carolina A&T's class before I looked at Southern's, I was like, man, that's my point. Like, this is a class that stands out. But once I looked at Southern's class, it was clear. But Alcorn State was right there. Like, it could have gone Alcorn State at three or two. They did a phenomenal job. They had five three-star kids, recruited Mississippi very well. Some guys, I mean, anytime, again, that you can get a three-star quarterback, which they did in this Adams kid, who is a local kid. Obviously, he's going to learn under Noah Johnson a little bit and then hopefully be ready for 2020. You know, they were able to also get a couple of FBS transfers that can sort of help them right away as well. I mean, I just think Alcorn State with the number of three-star kids, five three-star kids, did an absolutely tremendous job. A&T at number two. As I mentioned, they had, you know, to me, I thought their class was going to be number one. They had 2 3-star running backs from out of the state of North Carolina. 2 of these kids had ECU on their, you know, on their radar. And I think because A&T beat ECU, it could have been a direct connection between the why these guys picked A&T over ECU.
Right,
You know, I thought they did an absolutely tremendous job. I thought, you know, they just did a really good job with their class. They also had a couple of 3-star kids. One of the 3-star kids that they had was a kid out of Cali that I mentioned. Standback is his last name. 6'7", 250 pounds. 3-star kid, had a bunch of other offers. Think about it. Here's Darryl Johnson that's leaving to go to the National Football League. Insert perhaps Standback. We'll see how that plays out just because A&T recruits FBS-level defensive linemen. Now, Darryl Johnson did not redshirt when he came in. Maybe this kid Standback will be a guy that will be special and won't redshirt and can come in and help them right away. Of course, we'll have to see how that goes. And then number one, again, Southern at number one. They had 7 3-star recruits. What more can you say about that? 7 3-star recruits, a lot of guys that can come in and help them right away. I think the jewel of the class is this kid, Bertrand Correll. He had 11 FBS offers, LSU, Arizona, Missouri. The three of those 11 FBS offers, he spurned those schools to attend LSU. So, and then you add the other 3 3-star kids, or other 6 3-star kids that they had. I mean, what more can you say? I think Coach Odoms has done a tremendous job, and this was the first time that they were number one in our class. So, Southern definitely the head of the class and number one in our recruiting classes.
So you put a bullet on these guys back, Southern.
Yeah, you know, I think with some of the guys that they got, my thing is this, if those guys aren't playing right away, then you have some pretty good guys. I mean, let me clarify a little bit. Just because you have the star by your name doesn't always mean you're going to be this great player. I mean, and then vice versa. You could not have a star by your name and be a great player, a la Tariq Cohen and others who didn't have stars by their name, who were barely recruited, right, who were doing big things in the National Football League. But I just think Southern is going to have a really good year, and we saw what they were able to do last year, you know, almost winning the SWAC championship.
Well, I know you have to go here pretty shortly, but a couple of questions. How do you explain the phenomena of so many of these kids spurning the larger schools for HBCUs? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think this is a little – I don't know if this is insider information, but – so when you – and I'm not saying it's like that with all of these kids, but sometimes you'll look and they'll say, okay, LSU offered a kid. Well, it depends on what they offered him. You know, the offer could have been a partial scholarship. It could have been, half a scholarship or whatever the case may be, where maybe one of our schools offered him a full scholarship. So, you know, some of those things factor in. But I think more so, I think with the exposure – from the Celebration Bowl, the game on ABC, when you look at particularly the MEAC, I know the MEAC and the SWAC have a nice deal with ESPN, but I think what the MEAC was able to do this year and sort of expanding its deal with ESPN3 and ESPN+ and all of that really has helped our schools, particularly this year, in terms of recruiting. But what I'm interested in, guys, is seeing how it looks in the future. Will we continue to see our schools consistently getting these 3-star kids and hopefully starting to get 4-star kids as well? So, I think this was a really good year, but we'll see how next year and the remaining years play out.
And the other question is that, you know, as you were talking, it seems that schools, you know, have started to expand their recruiting territory and being more national, you know, rather than just staying exclusively in state. Is that a product of that, of the exposure as well, or what's that about?
Yeah, I think if one comes to my mind, I think a good point, Roscoe. I think one that comes to my mind, which is a direct connection to the exposure that our schools are receiving, is the Elijah Bell wide receiver kid from A&T. He was the player, he was like the Gatorade Player of the Year, won the Randy Moss Award in high school in West Virginia of all places. Big time wide receiver, right? Didn't have the stars by his name. Another kid didn't have the stars by his name for whatever reason. Big time wide receiver saw Tariq Cohen run up and down the field on Alcorn State and said, "I'm choosing to go to A&T," and that's where he went. So you are starting to kind of see that, and that's just one example. So, yeah, it's becoming more of a national recruiting footprint. I think schools, because of budgetary reasons, and just for example, I mean, if you're Florida A&M or you're Bethune-Cookman, I mean, how much do you really need to leave the state? If you're, you know, Texas Southern or Prairie View A&M, how much do you really need to leave the state? Even, you know, the North Carolina schools, so on and so forth. But I think you are going to see schools recruit more nationally because of the exposure provided by ESPN, Celebration Bowl, et cetera.
Right, right. Well, Donald, I know you have to run, but we certainly appreciate you taking the time to come in and chat with us and, you know, let us know where the players are going and who's going to be doing what in the future. Do a great job, and thanks again.
No problem.
Thanks,
I appreciate
Donald.
You guys having me. Thanks. Yes, sir. You got it.
A lot of knowledge there on that. And recruiting is such an incredible and integral part of what's going on. And it gives everybody hope when you see these rankings of these classes.
Well, recruiting actually is a season unto itself, you know. And I know in Mississippi, when I was working there, the Ole Misses and the Mississippi States and folk like that put as much stock in who won the recruiting battle as they did in who actually won the games on the field in the fall.
Right.
It's just that big. Just that big. And really, you know, recruiting is the lifeblood of all of these programs, because if you don't get the players in, then you don't win. And from a coach's perspective, if you don't win, you know, you're out selling insurance, selling used cars or whatever, you know, coaches do when they get fired. So it's for Donald to be able to track that, I'm just blown away by how he's able to do that and how he can retain that and, you know, regurgitate it so well. And I had my ass off to him. I'm impressed.
Oh, for sure. And I was thinking about the Tennessee State again, about how they recruit within the state. When you have a state like Tennessee or Georgia, Alabama, or Florida, where you just have – you're laden with football talent, and you can't – you know, and there's enough for you in addition to, like, you know, the University of Tennessee or Vandy getting players, Georgia or Georgia Tech. There's a lot more kids left in your state. And, you know, you're fighting for the schools that are – fighting the schools in the surrounding areas. I'm thinking about Deshaun Watson, who was a quarterback at Gainesville High School in Georgia, but ended up at Clemson. You know, you think about just how a pitched battle it is for these guys and the coaches and what they have to do. Because that, to me, that's harder than having to really go out there and practice with these kids every day, is getting out there having to sell their programs.
Right. You look at a state like Louisiana, you know, Grambling, Southern, LSU, all the Monroe.
All the Louisiana schools,
Louisiana
Monroe's.
Yeah. So it's tough. It's tough, and you really have to be on top of the game to woo these guys. And, you know, you can't just show up, you know, with a sweatshirt and a yearbook and expect the guys to become a part of your program. You have to, you know, show them something, you know, that, you know, will impress them and grab their attention. And, you know, one of the things that would do that, of course, is winning. And, you know, so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. But as Donald was alluding to, though, it's going to be a couple of years or so before we really know how these classes are paying out.
Right.
Because for the most part, you know, if you're playing a lot of freshmen, you're probably in trouble.
True. But if he has some sort of security where they say, look, we'll give you 3-4 years and you allow your classes to come in and allow you to have 2 or 3 recruiting classes, and then you can then we'll see where you are. I just think back to these coaches. I'm not as close to these coaches as I was when I was covering them, and I don't see where there are too many towering personalities that can come into my living room and sell me on a program like having a W.C. Gordon or Eddie Robinson or a Marino Kaplan come to your house and say, you know, not only are you going to be a great football player or, you know, you're going to be, I'm going to take care of your kid. You know, it's like having Nick Saban come into your house or Dabo Sweeney. It's a tough one.
Right. You know, in the old days, you know, guys like, you know, Kaplan and Big John and Mayor Jake Gaither, you know, they come into your house. They didn't even have to come into your house, you know. They, you know, their reputation preceded them. You know, guys just wanted to be a part of that program, you know, because they cast such a large shadow. And you're right, there aren't really any dominant personalities in the coaching ranks today. You know, some good coaches, but not the personalities that, you know, we used to know. And,
the larger than life guys.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just how it is. But to be honest, I kind of miss those guys.
Oh, for sure. To me, they sold the brand of HBCU football. They did it for their conferences and they did it for their individual schools, but they were HBCU football and they garnered respect outside of what we would call the Chitlin circuit. And so it was a different time when these people had to respect what they did. A lot of times you would think, I remember talking to Doug once about the NFL and what they do with kids, but they wouldn't really drafting the HBCU stars higher. And, you know, they always talk about how these kids are diamonds in the rough, as if they got no coaching on that level. But we know that that's not true. And we know that there was some, so much so that some people would even take an offense, tailor it to an outstanding player from that conference, and then call it the West Coast offense. I'm not calling any names.
Well, I was talking to Dwayne Harper out of South Carolina State last week, played corner 12 years in the NFL with the Seahawks, Lions, and Chargers, and he was saying how, you know, the transition for him to the NFL was easy because basically they did at South Carolina State the same thing that they were doing, you know, when he joined the Seahawks. I mean, the terminology, the schemes, everything. And so that, you know, his position coach, you know, was kind of concerned because he didn't have any questions. But, you know, you don't have questions if you understand what's going on. And it's obvious
right.
that he understood what was going on because, you know, he lasted for 12 years playing cornerback, which is a testament in itself, you know. And while, you know, he wasn't, you know, one of the, you know, big-time, big-name players coming out, you know, he was a solid player. So that just goes to show you the kind of coaching that goes on at these HBCUs that's kind of overlooked and underappreciated.
We're talking about these guys that were recruited, and these are 3-star, 4-star, 5-star kids. And then you look at some folks who weren't recruited, and I think that you saw one on Friday night at the award ceremony, Saturday at the award ceremony, pick up some hardware where Tariq Cohen and Darius Leonard were named Black College Football Pro Players of the Year this past year, where Tariq was the catalyst for the Chicago Bears' offense. They may have had Mitch Trubisky at quarterback, but I think Tariq Cohen pretty much bailed the Bears' offense out on a number of occasions. And then you have Darius Leonard, who's a rookie this year with the Indianapolis Colts, where I think he set a record for rookies for tackles. He led the teams in tackles this past year. And I think even the NFL Rookie of the Year, Defensive Rookie of the Year, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
So two guys that were honored there, but also, you know, just, you know, one was highly, highly touted. The other one, nobody knew about until he got to the pros. So those are big, big deals.
Well, Tariq, you know, the Bears, I mean, really, they built their offense around him because he does so many different things, you know, from running the ball out of the backfield to catching it to throwing it to returning kicks, and they use him strategically, and, you know, he really is their catalyst, you know, when he, you know, makes a big run, makes a big catch, it really gets them going. So, you know, and he's just, you know, he's not in the mode of Walter Payton, but he's in that same kind of category in the tradition of the, you know, outstanding running backs that the Bears have had over the years, you know, Payton, Willie Gallimore, Neil Anderson, you know, they just had some really great, great running backs. And, you know, he's doing it in a different way. You know, Gale Sayers, you know, he's just doing it in a different way. But, you know, the Bears have always had, for the most part, had some, you know, strong running backs, and he's continuing that.
Well, that speaks volumes for the quality of players that you are there in the MEAC, and I think that's why when it comes time for draft, when it comes time for selecting kids for combine and that kind of thing, you're looking for kids to get invites from the MEAC and from the SWAC, more so than maybe the other lower-level schools. But it's like it is. If you're talented, they will find you, and they always seem to find these kids. And these kids don't disappoint when they get on the next level, which is a testament to the job the coaches that are doing and those programs. They figure they can trust those cats, as opposed to saying, like, a, you know, somebody comes up with all the accolades, like a Ryan Leaf or somebody like that, who flame out. So,
but I can't remember an instance where an athlete from the HBCU who was dominant in his conference, you know, flamed out in the pros. You know, if he dominated in SWAC, if he dominated in EAC, he went on to have, you know, a solid, if not spectacular, NFL career. I mean, that's just how it has been.
I think of the Hall of Famers that are from the HBCUs, and they all took care of business on that level. And then they almost seamlessly made the adjustment to the NFL.
All right. But we can't say the same, you know, about, you know, athletes from the FBS level. You know, look at the number of Heisman Trophy winners who, you know, have just, you know, dropped off the face of the earth once they got to the NFL. You know, they just couldn't. Their production and performance didn't match, you know, the height that they received.
Yeah, well, as you say that, I think along those lines, where these guys, I don't even respect the Heisman. When I see a kid that wins a Heisman, I say that's really nice, but that doesn't guarantee success on the next level. Johnny Manziel is the most recent example of not coming through after a bunch of accolades there. So it kind of diminishes that. I think that whatever you get on the from HBCUs, you earn because of where you're coming from. I want to hit on a couple of other notes from HBCUs here. And it's like FAMU this year has his 11-game schedule. Only three of them are out of state. Now, how sweet of a schedule is that? And last year they really came on. And do you think that having 8 of 11 games this year inside the state of Florida is going to help them?
There's nothing like home cooking. I really do. And when you think that was just Coach Simmons' you know, first season and you know, what he was able to do. And you have to think that with the year of experience in his system, they will be improved. That's, you know, I look for them, you know, to really, really challenge in the MEAC for the championship, you know, and staying in state will really help. Will help a lot. You know, they will get a lot of fan support at those games, and it bodes well for them.
Really, yeah, the three games that they go out of the state for, they're at Norfolk State at the end of September. Then they're at South Carolina State October 12th, and then their last road game is October 26th when they go to Baltimore to play Morgan. Otherwise, they're in the state.
Well, South Carolina State, you know, regardless of where they play, that's always a pretty tough game for them, but the other two are very, very winnable games. So, you know, a 9-2 record is, you know, very conceivable. Even 10-1, if things break right for them. So, I mean, they're really, really set up for a big season, and you know, that's what championships are won in a lot of instances. You know, championships are won by the schedule maker, oftentimes. You know, playing or not playing the right schools, and where you play them, and when you play them, and that kind of thing makes a big, big difference.
Well, you see where they're at, because their first three games are going to be tests, per se. Maybe two of the three, I put it that way. They kick off the season at Central Florida, which has been a rock solid top 10 program on the FCS level the past couple of years. And then they're in the Jet Gaither Classic against Fort Valley, which is a win. It looks like it's going to be a win. And then they close out the first three games, September 21st, playing at home against Southern. So, and that's when then the next week they open up conference play when they're at Norfolk. So that's a big first three games there for them.
Right, that's a big game. I mean, that's one of those traditional rivalries that was played for a lot of years and then went away, and now it's coming back. But that's always has been a good rivalry, and one that you know, I hated to see go away, and that promises to be a real interesting game. You know, you have to give FAMU a bit of an edge, you know, playing at home. And, you know, Norfolk State, they've struggled. So that should be a win. North Carolina Central, we don't know who and what they're going to be with Trey Oliver as their coach, you know, in spite of the recruiting class.
Evidently, Sam has some inkling because Central is their homecoming game. I remember one year I covered Mississippi Valley, and I think of their 11 games, seven of them, they were homecoming opponents.
Yeah, Coach Jeffers would say that they had a float because it was in everybody's homecoming parade. Yeah.
That was so when you see that, it's like, yeah, that's somebody trying to tell you something about your program. But yeah, you said States is probably one that's winnable, but then they got A&T at home.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how well A&T is able to, you know, sustain its run of success, because they lost quite a few seniors. In addition to Darryl Johnson, the declared for the draft, losing a quarterback, Lamar Renard, and also running back, but you know, they do they do redshirt a lot of guys, so they have some experience coming back, but that probably means that their depth won't be quite as experienced. So
right.
Yeah, but
and then when you think
by that time in the season, some of those guys should have grown up some, so that should make for a good matchup.
Right, then it's the home stretch where they got Eric Morgan home against Dale State and Howard, and it's like it's a bookend. They opened at Central Florida, they end the season in Orlando in the Citrus Bowl or the Camping World Bowl or whatever the name of the stadium is. They're playing Bethune in the Classic to end the season.
Well, I bet they've lost 7 in a row to
yeah.
8 in a row or whatever it is. So
irrespective of the record, that does not
yeah.
they have their problems.
Plus the law of averages, you know, they're going to beat them sometime, beat them at some point. You know, it's got to happen. This very well could be the year.
Very well, it could be. I want to switch gears to professional football and what went down. I think it was Thursday or Friday, where Colin Kaepernick settled with the National Football League. Nobody's talking about the money, but the idea is it seems as if a settlement to me is an admission on some level of guilt in terms of the teams not allowing him the opportunity to regain his career. Do you look at it the same way?
Well, I look at it that way, and also that you don't want people to start poking around and asking questions and digging and turning up stuff because as the guy at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is learning that they start finding other stuff, you know.
Right.
You know, more than what you find stuff that you're not necessarily looking for, and that could well be the case with the NFL. So, you know, the prudent thing to do is throw a little money at it and, you know, make it go away that way.
Does the settlement preclude him from ever getting back in the league? Is that just definitely close?
No. It doesn't because Eric Reed, you know, signed with
the Ravens.
Contract with the
Panthers. Excuse me.
Not the Panthers. The Panthers resigned,
yeah.
And I think like a 3-year deal. So,
but to that sounds, I guess, an admission on their part because they settled with him as well. But he there was a talk of an excessive drug test throughout the season, as if it was like some form of harassment. And so,
they did an investigation and found that there was nothing there, which is still kind of hard to believe for my
right.
money, that he was tested, what was it, 7 times?
Right.
And he didn't play the full season. He was signed. In,
right. He
signed
like about 6 or 7 games, didn't he?
He signed well into the season, yeah.
So that does seem a bit excessive. So and that's something there, because I understand that people were saying there are two options out there that either Carolina or New England would be the destinations for Kaepernick. And could you see America falling in love with the Patriots with Kaepernick as their quarterback? And do you think that's a good? That would be a place for the land where you have a very strong coach and a system in place, where people pretty much will not question the move if Bill Belichick does it, as opposed to if Jason Garrett were to do something in Dallas, which is really not likely with the quarterback
well,
they have there.
I don't see Kaepernick as being a good fit in the Patriots system, and that's the key thing, is with him is for the type of quarterback he is, that he goes to his team that plays the style and system that suits his skills. You know, he's more of a dual threat type guy. And that's what made him so effective. And New England's whole, their whole being, that's not what they're about.
Right.
And, so that
and I'm trying to think
be...
of offenses where they could possibly be a fit, but you got Seattle run something where you have a quarterback that's mobile and does some things there. You have the same, I think, in Tampa where you have a guy that's mobile.
Right.
But you don't have you don't have a whole lot of offenses that are like that.
Well, we don't know what we have in Arizona.
True.
You know, with
but I've seen Josh Rosen, and Josh Rosen is a little bit more mobile than the statue, but he's got a great arm.
But Coach Handsome, you know, being the coach, what kind of system is he going to run?
Right.
And that, you know, we really don't know. And, you know, at the college level, you know, he had those, you know, wide open offenses with the mobile quarterbacks. It wasn't, you know, the pocket passing kind of scheme.
Now, do you think the signing of Kareem Hunt by Cleveland accelerated this deal? Because you look at it where it's a guy's on video striking a woman, and NFL says, okay, we're cool with that. Come sign with the Cleveland Browns, where you get a guy who's protesting social justice, injustice, and he can't get a sniff in the National Football League. Do you think something with the optics to that might have played into the decision?
No, I don't. I think that the settlement stands on its own merit that, you know, their goose was pretty much cooked, you know, regardless of what happened with Kareem Hunt. And it's interesting that, you know, Hunt did get a contract. And it just goes to show, you know, in comparison to Ray Rice, it just kind of reinforces what I've said all along, that Rice's not being in the league had, do I want to say more, as much, or whatever to do with his dwindling production as, you know, the incident and his actions, because if you recall, his production had started to tail off. And
right.
Had he been at the in his prime years, you know, I wonder what would have happened.
Probably so, what you're thinking. I think if you're still a commodity, teams will rationalize signing you, irrespective of what misdeed that you've done. I'm thinking that the Gordon kid at New England. I mean, he got another shot after repeatedly messing up, and then he messed up in New England, and he was gone. But the fact that he was even got another opportunity because he was a talent, and he showed that in the games that he played with New England, but he couldn't. You know, that kind of thing. If you're good, they'll find a place for you and squirrel you away. If you're good, or you pretend, or you have the prospects of being good, somebody's going to throw money at you. And I say that thinking of the signing yesterday of Manny Machado with the San Diego Padres with a 10-year, $300 million contract. So if doing the quick math, he's pulling down $30 million a year. if only I kept the ball in back in my boy's hands. that's just mind-boggling. And from what I understand, Bryce Harper, who has Scott Boras as an agent, who I think also is Machado's agent, Boras has turned down several $300 million contracts for Bryce Harper. And here it is, you know, the first week. And I think spring training games start on Saturday. I don't think they're in any rush because he's a hot commodity. But who turns their nose up at $300 million?
Not Roscoe Alfonso Nance. I tell you what, you know, I can't even get fathom that. I can't fathom that. But hey, you know, it's that kind of market, I suppose. And I put it this way: you're worth whatever.
What they'll pay you.
You know, what they'll pay you. Whatever someone's willing to pay you, that's what you're worth.
It seems like, you know, a while ago people were just like, Reggie Jackson signed for $2 million a year. What is this world coming to? No, he said, like, you
well,
know, and I remember my mom, you know, she was just incredulous when Magic Johnson signed a 25-year, $25 million contract. Yeah, he was going to average $1 million a year, and she could not understand that.
I can remember when it was a big deal to have a $100,000 a year contract.
Yeah.
$100,000
jobs.
$100,000 nowadays is not even walking around money.
Nah, I think the average NFL salary coming in, I think it's around $600,000. You know, the kids making that kind of money. Just for being on the roster, holding the clipboard, just making sure your socks are pulled up right, you're getting paid $600. You know, it's really interesting to see the kind of money being thrown around with it. Baseball more so, because all the baseball money is guaranteed. Other sports don't have it like, well, football didn't have it like that.
Well, basketball is guaranteed.
But baseball is guaranteed. All of it. And so you don't have a care in the world except to try to hit that ball or throw it and catch it. So,
But Dick Motto once told me something that was very insightful. And he said, when someone hits the lottery, what do they do? They retire.
Oh yeah.
And in sports, big contracts, you know, a lot like hitting the lottery. And once these guys sign these big contracts, they treat it like they hit the lottery, and they retire. You know, only the difference is they still show up to work. But in effect, they have retired, and they, you know, started out just. You know, mailing it in a lot of cases because, you know, the incentive is gone. So it just comes down to, you know, your personal drive and your, you know, just your character and your desire, you know, to push yourself because, you know, when you're coming up, you know, the motivation is to make a name for yourself, to increase your earning power. And once you get there, you look around and, okay, I'm there now. Now what?
Yeah.
And that's what set a guy, you know, like the, you know, the true superstar guys apart. You know, they were self-motivated and they weren't satisfied with just being, you know, the best player and the best paid player. You know, they had a certain standard that
they want to be the best
wanted to maintain, that they wanted to play to and you know, and maintain, and you know, day in and day out. And I know Michael Jordan, you know, his attitude was that I'm the best player in the NBA. And I'm playing in Seattle tonight, and this might be the only time that a fan sees me play. And if I don't put on a good performance, then that's the impression that he has of me. You know, he wanted to, every night, he wanted the fans who saw him play to leave the arena saying that I've seen the best player ever. So he tried to play to that level night in and night out.
But every night, you did get that from him. But it wasn't so much driven by the paycheck. But I know that our illustrious producer, Ricky Hampton, threw something my way where this golfer who won $100,000 for a season in 1969 was looked at as really doing something. Where these cats throw that around on shoes these days. So, you know, it's just a different world than what it had been. But maybe by this time next week, Harper will have signed, and we know by this time next week we'll have another really great show for you guys. We want to again thank Donald Ware for being with us tonight and sharing with him his knowledge on FCS HBCU recruiting. And until we see you guys again next time, we want to give everybody the opportunity to do what, Nasco?
To, by all means, express yourself.
See you next time.